Welcome to Forces of Fantasy, a podcast dedicated to all things Warhammer Fantasy and then some. I'm your host, Gert-Jan van Heugde, but since you probably can't pronounce that, I'll just go by my initials, GJ. Hello everyone, welcome back to the Forces of Fantasy podcast. This is a podcast episode where we will discuss past, present, and future, though not necessarily in that order. Before we go to the past and jump into our time machine as you are used from these episodes, we will take a look at not only what's currently on my painting table, but also, and I think that's much more exciting, what has Games Workshop announced for next Saturday? Because next Saturday it is the 14th of October, and that means it's Warhammer Day. This Warhammer Day, we are getting some reveals about the old world. There's going to be some pretty major reveals for Warhammer the Old World. They say, and I quote, things kick off at 2 p.m. BST, that stands I think for British Standard Time, and there is a real welter of stuff to unveil. New books and miniatures for Warhammer 40k and Age of Sigmar, a new box and new faction for Kill Team, and big news for Warhammer the Old World. Now, they don't necessarily say here what type of big news we are to expect, whether this is going to be more miniatures, more previews, or whether we are finally getting a release date. I certainly hope it's going to be the latter, although I'd rather that they do this right than hurry this along because they want to catch the 40-year Warhammer celebration and use the hype of that to push out this product. Now, after this article, this was, October the 2nd that they put this out. I mentioned it on the show a couple of weeks ago. After that, they also released another article on October the 9th, 2 days ago at the time of recording, saying Warhammer Day is coming and so are some juicy new reveals. In this post, there is a reveal for a Bretonnia Battle Standard Bearer on foot. At first I thought this might just be a regular Foot Knight Standard Bearer, but they specifically say in the text that this is a Battle Standard Bearer. This tells us, well, at least two things. One of the things is that Bretonnia is getting probably a lot more focus on the infantry troops, and the other one is that Battle Standard Bearers are still part of the game. There's really no reason why they shouldn't be, because they've been around since at least 4th edition. I'm not sure if they were already in 3rd edition, but their uses have been rather limited, at least up to 8th edition. In 4th and 5th edition, a Battle Standard Bearer was basically a hero, so he had, a champion, so he had one wound and the profile to boot. Rather squishy. In 6th and 7th edition, they changed him from a champion level to a hero level. And then still you could not take any magic items if you took a magic standard. In all of those editions, Battle Standard Bearers could be used to reroll break tests only. It was only in 8th edition that a Battle Standard Bearer could be used for rerolling all psychology tests and break tests, making it at least more useful, but basically nobody left home without a BSB unless you were undead or something and you didn't really need it for the extra wound of combat reduction. Extra combat results that you would normally lose after after a break test instead of taking a break test. Oh, you know how it works for undead. So, Battle Standard Bearers, I think they will still be used for rerolling all psychology tests, because I think that is a mechanic that I know a lot of people in who still play, for example, 6th edition, have retroactively put into their games as a house rule. You could use your BSB to reroll all psychology tests. If that is the case, then it would make a lot more sense to have your BSB on foot than to have him mounted. Because in Bretonnia, and this is just talking about a Bretonnian army, in Bretonnia, your knights usually run off to the front, and there is your general who has a high leadership, so you don't really need a battle standard bearer most of the time. And there is also your unit of grill knights that are immune to psychology anyway. There are your regular knights that are immune to psychology if it is caused by peasants, your questing knights that are immune to panic, caused at least all sorts of panic, and immune to psychology tests caused by peasants. So it would make much more sense to have your battle standard bearer holding back somewhere in the back ranks amongst the peasants, although it makes probably a bit less of a thematic sense. It is more useful in game terms to have him amongst your low leadership peasants that take panic tests left, right, and center if something happens. I think that is why they have decided to bring this foot model out. We've also gotten reveals for Bretonnia showing that foot knights are going to be a thing. We have not yet seen the actual models themselves, but we did get some bits that I highly expect to be of those foot knights, because you had knight arms with swords, and it doesn't make sense if your knights are mounted, because these were your regular swords, not the great swords for questing knights. So yeah, regular swords, anyone who puts their knight on a horse will also give him a lance. Foot knights, on the other hand, they would be pretty decent with a sword and shield combination, especially if you still have things like a parry save. So that's what I expect will happen, at least for Bretonnia. We've gotten a lot of reveals in the past year showing both old miniatures and some concepts and some actual miniatures that are quite new. So far, we've only seen a few new models for Bretonnians and Tomb Kings. It is to be expected that these will then also become the two armies that will feature in the starter box, assuming they're going to do something like a starter box, although I believe they hinted at that there won't be an actual starter box, but there will be something like army sets or so. I don't really remember what they said about that. But yeah, I hope next Saturday a lot of things will become more clear. Alright, that's enough speculation about the future. I will probably try to put out, depending on the quality of the reveal, something during the weekend to keep you all posted. I might either do that as a podcast, or I might try to do that as a video. I'm not sure yet. It will all depend on what has been shown, and also on how much time I have. Now, before we jump into the past, let's also talk a bit about the present, because I have some things on my painting table, and I've been doing some things in the moments between recording the last episode and recording this episode. I mentioned last week that I had shot a video battle report of my High Elves fighting my Bretonnians. These were the two armies I used for a recent game day. That video is now up on YouTube. If you go to youtube.com/@forcesoffantasy, and at is the at symbol, the same one you use in emails, so that's youtube.com/@forcesoffantasy, If you go to that channel, you will find the battle report. This is an abridged battle report where I give a little overview of what happened after each turn, the same way I do with the Mordheim battle reports that I have up on the channel. There is also a full-length battle report where you can see all the dice rolling and everything, but in order to view that, you'd have to be a member of the Forces of Fantasy Patreon. There is really not much that is keeping you from joining the Forces of Fantasy Patreon, because the Forces of Fantasy Patreon is non-tiered, meaning that you can join for as little or as much as you like each month. Your contribution will help me keep the lights on and will help me produce more content and better quality content. So basically, this is just an investment in your own entertainment value. Alright, enough with the whole commercial side of things. Apart from filming this battle report and editing it and getting it out there, I have also been working on some miniatures. Currently on my painting table are Heinrich Kemmler and a dwarf organ gun. These are for, respectively, the Call of the Crown 3 painting challenge and the Tale of Fourth Gamers. For both of these challenges, I have chosen to do a small number of models this month because I also want to paint a lot of goblins. I was a bit late in starting with these challenge miniatures because I first wanted to finish 2 warbands. I'm not sure if I mentioned that last week on the podcast. I might have, but anyway, I finished the Witch Hunters warband. I needed 2 Witch Hunters and a couple of puppies for that one. I had the rest of the miniatures already painted. And I also finished a complete Sisters of Sigmar warband, which I made using 3D printed miniatures, mostly from Highlands Miniatures. They make some excellent Sisters of Sigmar proxies. These 2 warbands are now finished. They are sitting in next to my painting table on the windowsill. I still need to put some flock and detailing on their bases, but other than that, they are finished. I will probably have a game of Mordheim next week, in which I might try to get these warbands involved. We're going to play again in the map campaign that Roland and I have started last time. And also, again, if you are interested in that, you can follow along on my YouTube channel. Now, it is very dangerous, for me at least, to browse the Mordheim Warbands websites. So, for example, I usually go to broheim.net. That's a site where you can find basically all of the resources for Mordheim. And they have a very extensive list of warbands, including a rating on how official they are. And it was when looking at this, might have been prompted by something I saw on Facebook, that there is also the option for a Lizardman warband. And then I saw that I have almost a complete functioning Lizardman warband already ready to go, except for a Skink Shaman and another Skink Hero or Skink Champion. So I already have a Skink Shaman that I undercoated at some point and that I gave a base coat with the airbrush. He's already blue, I only need to do all the details on him. And I then dug out a blister with a Skink command group where I found a Skink Champion holding a sword and javelins that I can use as one of the heroes. So if I paint these 2 miniatures, I will also have a Lizardman warband that can run around in Mordheim. Not sure yet if I'm going to do that before Wednesday, probably not. But depending on how it goes and how I feel, judging as how we usually only get 1 or 2 games in an evening anyway, and I already have 2 new warbands, plus a Beastman warband that I have not yet used, I'm probably just going to skip on the Lizardmen for now, but prepare them and make sure that I can use them when I need them. I might also bring one or two of my Mordheim warbands to the Dutch Oldhammer Con. There is a Oldhammer Games event on October the 28th. If you're interested in that, there is a website on Facebook, a Facebook page called the Dutch Oldhammer Con, where you can find all of the information. If you don't have Facebook, then just pop me a message if you're interested. The Dutch Oldhammer Con, I will host a big 5th edition, 4th or 5th edition game, multiplayer game, where we will have 2,000 point armies on each side. And don't know yet how many people will join, but I know there will also be some Mordheim, probably there will be some Manowar. We are expecting some international guests, including some people from the Crown of Command Discord, and some people who are also, I believe, listeners to this show. So it would be great to see everybody in person there. So if you're in the neighborhood, if you have the time to come to the Netherlands, please join in. It's not quite free to join. There's a couple of euros entry fee, but I think that will certainly not be a problem if you're taking the time to come to the Netherlands to pay the entry fee to join for this event. I think that I have now mentioned most of the things, if not all of the things that I wanted to mention pertaining to the present and the future. So now let's do what you all came here for and jump into our time machine to head back to the good old days of Warhammer Fantasy 2nd Edition. If I could turn back time. We're on our way to 1984, the year the world was introduced to Boulder Dash. And then of course I'm not talking about the word which according to an etymological dictionary stems from the 16th century. I'm talking about the board game Boulder Dash. It's a parlor game where you have to guess the meaning of a real but rarely used word. Speaking of things that are real and rarely used, let's talk a bit about Warhammer 2nd Edition. We have been going through the 2nd Edition box set one book at a time, and today is nothing new. Today we are going to take a look at the third and final book that we got in the 2nd Edition box set, The Battle Bestiary. As the name suggests, this book contains a lot of profiles and a lot of background information on all the different creatures that inhabit the Warhammer world. But it is far more than that. The Battle Bestiary itself comprises the sections of this book from page 12 up to and including 48. Then on page 49 you get the army lists, and from page 54 until the end, well, which is page 54, is the last one, you get a creature index. Now, the first few pages of this book are, I think, more interesting than the last bit, because it is not really fun to read out a lot of profiles and a lot of stats, although it might be fun to compare some of them. But the first part of this book gives us a few play tips on how to use the Battle Bestiary, and it also gives us the known world, and that's what I think will be most interesting, because if you remember from a few episodes ago, I compared what was known in the Warhammer Fantasy First Edition lore to what we know in later editions when the Warhammer world has taken a bit more shape. You can see in First Edition already the seeds are there for the lore and background and for the way the world is supposed to look like, but it is not until 2nd edition that we get an actual world map and that we get a timeline. We get a description of the different continents and of the different peoples and creatures that inhabit these continents and regions. Let's start by taking a look at the section called Using the Battle Bestiary. As you expect, this gives you an overview of what's in the book. It says that this gives you the profiles, rules, and other information relevant to the creatures inhabiting the Warhammer world. Insofar as possible, the list covers all of the models currently made by Citadel Miniatures. We would recommend that the GM uses the rules as given, at least for his first few games. After that, we don't really mind. Adjust the rules and profiles to suit your own playing style and type of game. This is the umpteenth time where we have seen this in these first and second edition books. The rules are more like guidelines. Please go and do your own thing, have fun, invent your own scenarios, invent your own stats. Just use these rules to start you off, and then when you've gotten the hang of things, go nuts. Gamers wishing to use information contained within our Forces of Fantasy supplement for the first edition of Warhammer will have to adjust the profiles and some of the rules to fit in with this edition. This is especially of use for players who want to compare profiles across 1st and 2nd edition, or maybe I should say across 1st and later editions. To convert old profiles into new profiles, add 1 to the strength, convert toughness into a number and add 1, and you use the new personal characteristics throughout. So this means that if you have a dwarf, for example, we have seen some of the dwarves in the Ziggurat of Doom scenario. The dwarves have a strength of 2 and a toughness of C. You would have to add 1 to the strength, putting the strength up to 3. And the toughness, you convert the letter into a number, so C being the third letter from the alphabet would be number 3. And then you add 1 to that as well. So a strength 2 toughness C dwarf in first edition would be the same as a strength 3 toughness 4 dwarf in later editions. And we see, if you know your dwarves a little bit, that this is basically the profile or the strength and toughness that they will have up to and including 8th edition. Basically for your regular dwarf, not your more elite dwarf units that I'm talking about. Then we get some information on the models and the bases. Although Warhammer has been designed around standard 25 to 30 mm high metal models, there's no reason why players shouldn't use any of the currently available plastic 54 mm models instead. Citadel planned to release a comprehensive range of plastic models in 60 mm scale, compatible with and suitably heroic looking when playing alongside models from Britons, Matchbox, Airfix, etc. I have absolutely no idea if they ever did this, if Citadel ever put out models that were that scale. Well, I do know there's of course the Inquisitor range, but that is in a 40k setting, and that's basically all I know about Inquisitor, and even that may be wrong. So I'd have to look through the catalogs following this, and we will get to that at some point, whether or not Citadel have released 54 or 60 millimeter models that look a little bit more in line with models from other companies. I also love how at this point in time, Citadel and Games Workshop, they know their limitations and they know that we cannot produce all of the miniatures that people want to use, especially not if you want to do things that go beyond the book, and we actually encourage people to go beyond the book. So basically just use whatever miniatures you feel like and use the rules that that you like and bend the rules to suit your need. Then we have something on bases. The standard base sizes described in the rules are 20x20mm for infantry, 25x50mm for cavalry. Many of the larger humanoid creatures will not fit on a standard base and should be mounted on 25x25mm bases or any base that will fit. This is indicated in the descriptions of each creature. Large monsters and engines of war should be mounted on bases that look right, although it is best to round off to the nearest 5mm. So here we see something as well, that the rules are not so much restrictive, it's more about what fits, what works, what looks good. In later editions, especially in the 6th to 8th edition era, when you got the more tournament play oriented rules, you have to have your army on the correct basis. Because if you, for example, put your Chaos Warriors on 20mm bases, of course that won't fit, but you can get creative with some flyer stems, I guess. If you put your Chaos Warriors on 20mm bases, you get in a lot more attacks than when they are on 25mm bases. So there is a definite gameplay purpose to this. And also with the upcoming Old World, we now know that for the first time in 40 years, the base sizes overall are going to increase to keep up, I guess, with the scale creep of the miniatures. I don't know if you know this, but over the past 40 years, miniatures have gradually been getting larger, especially the plastic ones, the ones that were released in 8th edition, and those that had the more dramatic poses, like I remember the High Elf Phoenix Guard, the plastic High Elf Phoenix Guard. They have these billowing cloaks and they are really annoying to rank up. Much more annoying than the Monopose 4th edition metal ones. So there is a reason for that they're going on larger base sizes. But seeing as how I don't think there will be much of an end to skill creep, the base sizes will probably keep increasing. Right, anyway, we were talking about the past, not the future, so let's leave the future speculation for another episode and go back to the Battle Bestiary. Next, we get an introduction on how each of the creatures will be represented. They have divvied it up into physique, world distribution, alignment, base size, special rules, basic profile, basic points, and character profiles where appropriate. Not all creatures have all of these details. Many of the undead, ethereal, and demonic types have no fixed world distribution, for example. Only intelligent humanoid races have been given characters, although there's no reason why you shouldn't work out heroes or wizards for other appropriate creatures. Then it goes on to talk a little bit about the points value. It says that if you have, for example, goblins and animals, they have been given a low leadership value because that fits what they, the way they are, the way they behave, the way they are written. So that means that in combat you have to keep some heroes near them, otherwise they won't do what you want them to do. Similarly, some stupid creatures will spend nearly all of their time wandering about aimlessly. Trolls are a good example. The only way to maintain any order over these creatures is to have a hero leading them. Keep them in tight units in front or away from other troops is another tip you're getting here. Otherwise, you may find your army quickly fighting amongst itself. As an Orc and Goblin player, I have absolutely no idea what they are talking about here. On the whole, heroes are good value for points. Mounted heroes usually end up paying lots of points for horses, wolves, etc. because of the multiplier for equipment. A human major hero pays 9 times 6 equals 54 points for a horse. And this is where it gets a little bit weird. Because usually what you do is you get your hero, you have your standard human profile, you turn him into a minor hero, you turn him into a major hero that will cost you, with all the stat increases, 23 points extra. So your human major hero will be 5 points for your basic human plus 23 points for the hero upgrade, gives you a total of 28 points. 28 points falls within the 21 to 30 bracket, which means that you multiply the total by 3, and that's how you get to 84 points. Now, in the combat book, it says that horses and other mounts, they don't follow this rule, because what you do is you usually have your hero, and then you add your equipment, and then you add the multiplier. But horses and other mounts, a horse costs 1 point. If a horse is used as a mount, it costs 5 points extra. But if you use it as a mount for a minor hero or a champion, it's 10 points. And for a major hero, it's 20 points extra. So major heroes should pay 21 points for horses. However, what they did here is they took that 84 points bracket. They took the, which gives you a multiplier of 9, by the way. They took the value for a horse as a riding animal, which is 6 points. And they basically multiplied those two numbers. So, I'm not sure which of the two we have to follow here. It says that this is quite expensive, but it can still be good value. It can easily stand up to an equal points value of regular troops. However, wizards work out quite expensive, although the way the points modifiers work, this can mean that some wizards are definitely better value than others. This all helps add color and variety to the different creature types. Mounted wizards will work out very expensive indeed because of the equipment multiplier effects, and whether they are worth it or not will depend largely on how you envisage using them. So yeah, wizards are, as we saw in the last episode, rather expensive indeed. The reason for this is that not only do your wizards count points value for the stat increase, you multiply the total value by 10. So then you also add 10 points per spell available. We saw the example last time for a level 1 wizard with 3 spells. It's a level 1 human, 5.5 points because of the stat increase. Times 10, 55 points, plus 30 makes 85 points. That already puts you, for a level 1 wizard, in the same points bracket as your major hero. And it will only go up from there. So if you use these equipment multiplier rules, your level 1 wizard will get you to... again, 54 points for a horse. And if you go for a level 4 human wizard with all 12 of his spell slots, that will be a total points cost of 352.5 points. This means that you would pay 36 times 6 points for a regular horse, a regular mount, or 216 points. That's quite a lot for a normal horsey that only gives you a plus 1 armor save and some extra movement. So indeed, for a wizard, it will probably not be worth it. Now, you might remember that in first edition, you had a way of making armies by using battalions. Each battalion could consist of one faction, and each army consisted of three battalions that were, in one way or another, allied to each other. So you could have, for example, orcs and undead, because they were both evil, but you could not have orcs and wood elves, I believe. So, in second edition, it works a little bit differently. It says armies can be composed of either just one or of mixtures of several races. In forming mixed armies, the alignments of the creatures must be taken into account. Lawful and good troops cannot fight on the same side as evil or chaotic troops. Lawful and good troops may be allied to each other, and evil and chaos types may also be allied. Neutral types may ally themselves to any other alignment, but not law slash good and chaos slash evil at the same time. Here we see that instead of using different battalions, you just group everything together. This gives you so much more opportunity for playing with different miniatures. I know a lot of people like to collect different types of miniatures, and in second edition, there's really no reason why you should not have a unit of skeletons, a unit of orcs, a unit of chaos knights, and maybe some neutral troops like, I don't know, Elizabeth neutral, we'll find out. So something like that in there, top off with a few trolls and a catapult or two. That would make of a fun army, especially if you can get the fluff in order. If you say, well, why is this necromancer hiring orcs, or why is this orc general hiring a necromancer or using skeletons, for example, that can give you a lot of freedom, especially if you have varied collections and don't really want to tie yourself down to one particular army. Although, of course, in second edition, if you play a full goblin army or a full elf army, there is no stopping you there. The final section in this part of using the battle bestiary is on riding beast. This basically applies the same logic we just heard with allies, saying a lawful or good creature cannot ride a chaotic or evil beast, or vice versa, and neutral riding beast will take any rider. Now we get to the fun part. The known world, the Warhammer world or the old world, whatever you want to call it, was not yet known by that name back in the day. It is here simply the known world, with a capital K and a capital W. The known world bears more than a passing resemblance to our own. This is because the known world exists in a parallel reality, an alternative place or time, which is different from ours but not unrelated. So it is that many of the creatures of our world are common to this one, or have similar habits and customs. This basically gives you a good jumping off point if you want to envision the Warhammer world. Start by envisioning our own world and add in some fantasy elements. Now, before we dive into the different regions and their descriptions, which I am going to read out because I think these are very interesting to look at from a current era perspective. Before we do that, I'm going to skip ahead one page where we get the world map printed. The world map looks pretty much like you'd expect the Warhammer world map to look, although it is a bit more stylized. The coastlines are a bit more angular and some places have been shifted around a bit, so it's similar but not exactly the same as it will be in later editions. The world map looks very much like your standard, at least European-based world map in a regular map projection. So you have the North Pole spanning the entire northern edge of the map and the South Pole spanning the entire southern edge of the map. Then going from left to right, you have the Americas, and then Europe and Africa, and then Asia. The differences between our world and the Warhammer world is that the complete northern edge is all connected. So there is a connection between the westernmost tip of the Americas and the easternmost tip of Russia. The entire north is described as the Northern Chaos Wastes. North America and the connecting bit is called the New World. South America is called Lustria. Then going further to the east, you get a crescent shape island continent called the Elf Kingdoms, which is what later would become Ulthuan. It is very similar to Ulthuan in that it has an opening to the south. It's an almost complete circle, although it doesn't look quite like the dragon biting its tail that it did in later editions. Then you get some unnamed islands to the north, which would be Greenland and Iceland. And then in Northern Europe you have Norska. Going to the south you have the Old World, which is basically Europe, although distorted quite a bit, because the islands of Great Britain and Ireland seem to have been incorporated in continental Europe. Spain and Portugal look a bit off, Italy doesn't have the specific boot shape, but it looks a bit more like the Indian subcontinent. And then going to the south, you get Araby, which is the northwestern tip of what would be the continent of Africa. And below that you have the Southlands, which is the southern part of Africa. The west coast of Africa is called the New Coast. And dividing Araby and the Southlands are the World's Edge Mountains. They go all the way from the New Coast up to Norska. And then they branch off to the east into the Mountains of Mourne. These are the only two mountain chains that are mentioned on the map, although there are also some mountains in the New World, though they are unnamed. The World's Edge Mountains and the Mountains of Mourne, they form a sort of wishbone shape, and in between them are the Darklands. To the north and east of the Mountains of Mourne are the Northern Steppes, and where the Mountains of Mourne end, in what is obviously real-world China, you have Cathay. Apart from then the Northern and Southern Chaos Wastes, Southern Chaos Wastes are their own continent, and apart from the islands, all of these lands are interconnected. So the Southern Chaos Wastes are their own thing, the islands and the Elf Kingdoms are their own things, and then all of the other continents are all interconnected. Australia is absent from the map. This is also true for the Warhammer World map in later editions, although still a bit sad for our Aussie friends. Now, there are some changes between the map in this edition and the map in later editions. For example, the World's Edge Mountains. In later editions, they go all the way from the north of Norska to the south tip of the Southlands. Here in this edition, they go more or less north to south, but they do deviate towards the west and they don't continue on all the way to the south. There are a few differences, but in general, the known world is what you expect the Warhammer world to be. Let's take a look at the different areas in this world. The Old World is a temperate weather zone originally covered with deciduous forests. Nowadays, much of the land has been cleared for agriculture, so that only a few large forests remain. The uplands approaching the World's Edge Mountains form natural grassland pasture and make excellent grazing for domestic animals. The large western island, the Isle of Albion, is known for its barren moorlands and bogs, although even this land is now mostly forested or under plough. The Old World corresponds to Europe during the Middle Ages, consisting of a number of small independent states sharing a similar cultural heritage and language. Humans are the dominant species here, although there are still remnants of other races living in out-of-the-way regions, such as the Borglands of the Isle of Albion, where a few gnomes still survive. Apart from these rare and secretive communities, there are also the dwarf kingdoms situated along the western margins of the World Edge Mountains. Amongst and within the mountains, the dwarves formerly built their mighty fortresses and vast cities. Today, only a few of the ancient cities are inhabited, and then only in part. Much of the underworld region of the mountains is dominated by goblins and their kin. The Old World is also the home of the halflings, who live sheltered lives under the protection and nominal leadership of the human kingdoms. The Old World is the most volatile and exciting place in the world, where whole populations are ready to embark on new adventures overseas. This is a time of expansion and exploration, as Old Worlders discover and begin to colonize places like Lustria, the New World, and the New Coast. In many ways, the Old Worlders are similar to the exploring, conquering countries of 15th and 16th century Europe. The southern parts of the Old World are already beginning to open to new ideas, science, and technology. Gunpowder weapons are in their infancy here, and experiments are going on with steam and alcohol power. The north of the Old World is still far poorer and more primitive, where feudal barons maintain their grips on the lives of the peasantry. So, for the Old World, although we do not yet see the Empire and Bretonnia arise, we already get the basic structure here, with the southern states, the mercenary states, to call them that, the dogs of war countries. They are a little bit more advanced, a little bit more experimental in their weaponry, and the Old World is a little bit more conservative. So the Old World proper, the northern part of the Old World, the Empire and Bretonnia. We see also, and that is something that has been pointed out to me, especially with regards to the dwarves, that there is an actual progression in the use of gunpowder and weaponry. For example, in the Empire and Dwarf books, there are in the earlier modern editions of Warhammer, so I'm making the division between Hero Hammer and 6th edition onwards. So in 6th edition, I believe, you could not have, say, an Empire Engineer with a Hellblaster volley gun because it was much too experimental at the time. Or you could, I believe, have the same thing with dwarves, or some runes could only be inscribed on cannons, ball throwers, and stone throwers, but not on, for example, organ guns or gyrocopters. And then later in 8th edition, you see that these bans have been lifted, and these formerly experimental weapons are now much more accepted, and engineers and runes can be assigned to them. So even though the timeline has not advanced very much between those editions, there is still a bit of a progression there and a bit of retconning. Let's go to the next subcontinent, which is Araby. Araby is a hot, dry place where water is never plentiful and few areas are really fertile. Much of the land is desert or shrubland, harboring scarce trees and necessitating careful irrigation to produce crops. Araby corresponds to the Near East at the time of the Ottoman Empire. It is a huge and decadent empire comprising of many caliphates, each under the watchful eye of the Sultan of all Araby. Like the Old World, Araby is dominated by humans sharing a common culture and language, Arabic. Also like the Old World, there are a number of remnants of other declining races who still survive in remote areas. As much of Araby is desert, remote areas are fairly common. The World's Edge Mountains are here, as everywhere, full of goblin strongholds and underground dwellings. Arabians do travel and trade quite extensively, but they lack the self-motivation of most Old Worlders and have not yet made any serious attempts to settle outside of their homeland. Technologically, they are becoming backwards, although this was not formerly so. Araby in later editions has more or less disappeared from the lore. It was still in lore, but it never got an army apart from Warmaster. And it is, I think especially after the events of 9/11, many Western companies are a bit careful with how they portray a predominantly Muslim area. So I guess there's a reason for that. But I think it's also a bit sad that we are letting ourselves be guided more by fear than by the richness of the culture, and of course not only the culture but also the stories from that realm. The stories that have for many generations spoken to people, stories like Sinbad, Aladdin, Ali Baba and the 40 Robbers. There are some great Arabian folk tales out there that definitely deserve a place in the Warhammer world. But that's just my opinion, and maybe not a politically correct one. Then again, I've always thought that political correctness is something that happens to other people. Next we get to Norska. Norska is a cold and harsh place, where the mountains march right to the seas and snow lies always upon the peaks. Most of the valleys are heavily forested by evergreens, although the inhabitants clear forests and farm as best they can. Fishing and hunting provide the best means of surviving for most intelligent creatures. Norska is populated mostly by humans, the fierce and warlike Norse. They share their barren land with the equally hardy Norse dwarves, as well as a number of underground goblinoid races living within the mountains. Norska is also home to ogres and trolls, creatures exceptionally rare, if not extinct, in the Old World. The various men and dwarves of Norska are relatively barbaric compared with their more civilized relatives to the south. Norska as a force has also disappeared from Warhammer, although we've seen some remnants remain, such as in Manowar, where you had a Norse fleet. What is now Norska here in this edition is mostly incorporated into Chaos as the Chaos Marauders. The Norse dwarves, they are mentioned. There might even be some sort of a Norse dwarf army in the back of the 6th edition dwarf army book. Not sure, I have to check. No, I was mistaken, there is not, though they are mentioned in the lore for 6th edition. And I believe also for later editions, but we'll get to that when we get to that. Then we go to the Southlands, here spelled with a space, so the Southlands are still largely unexplored and unknown. They consist of humid equatorial jungles with northern and southern belts of dry grassland. The Southlands harbor goblins as well as primitive tribes of humans, some still living a Stone Age hunter-gatherer existence. This has been completely retconned in later editions, where the Southlands are inhabited mostly by lizardmen. In 6th edition, you could have a Southlands list. This was a back of the book list. The Southlands list had mostly skinks as core units, Saurus warriors were special units, and this gave you an opportunity as a 6th edition player to field skinks with bows. Then we go to the New Coast. This is an area that I have not seen pop up in Warhammer lore in later editions, though I must admit I am not a lore expert, not by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just learning this all on the go and when doing this podcast. And of course I have some knowledge about the Warhammer world and all the races and things from playing. But most of the books I have not yet read, so for me this is also a big learning experience. The New Coast is the first Old Worlder settlement in the Southlands, comprising of a number of thriving towns and farms. The New Coast is a jungle to the north and dry grasslands to the south. The inhabitants of this area are mostly from the Old World, Norse or Dwarves. Together, these races are developing trade with the interior, and the dwarves are already beginning to tap the untold mineral wealth of the surrounding mountains. Like I mentioned, not really an area that is much developed in later editions. Its name even is, I believe, completely forgotten in later editions. Although what is mentioned here is a little bit reminiscent of what you have in Lustria with some Norse settlements there. We already mentioned in our look at first edition the town of Skegi, which later becomes a more developed Norse colony on the shores of Lustria. Next we get to the Darklands, also here spelled as two distinct words. The Darklands lie within a huge natural basin formed by the eastern side of the World's Edge Mountains and the Mountains of Mourne. The wall thus formed comprises many active volcanoes which pour their molten lava over the land. The constant smoke and airborne ash is so thick that very little light reaches the ground, and the Darklands have become barren and eternally dark. The Darklands are not thickly populated by any creatures, although they are home to most of the evil, black-hearted and unpleasant species that wouldn't be tolerated anywhere else. The surrounding mountains are riddled with goblin tunnels, or fortresses built by the dwarves and taken over by goblins years ago. Within these tunnels live all sorts of goblinoid creatures, as well as other nameless creatures that like to hide away from the sunlight. Deep below the deepest goblin tunnels are the caverns of the lizardmen, where few venture and from whence even fewer return. Now that's an interesting bit of information that I had not yet picked up on, that the lizardmen are in this edition a subterranean race. I had not expected them to be equated to the Slann, although later editions they are sort of meshed together. The Slann, of course, being the descendants of the Old Ones. Here in this edition, they still can walk, they don't have to be carried around or sit on floating chairs. But they are living in the areas that you in later editions would expect to be equated with lizardmen, so mostly in Lustria. Reading this description of the Darklands, it immediately gives me the idea that they have kept most of this, maybe not the eternal darkness, but it's definitely the whole land of lava and ash, and later made that home of the Chaos Dwarfs. So the Darklands themselves, I think they have not changed very much, apart from that they have now been inhabited by the followers of Hashut. Next we come to the Northern Steppes. The Northern Steppes comprise Arctic wastes to the north, tundra and grassland to the south, and border on desert to the far south. Over this vast and unmanaged territory wander various nomadic groups, herding their cattle and horses. Humans and goblinoid races all roam the steppes, whilst many large monsters rely on the steppelands for their food. The eastern edge of the mountains of Mourne provide ideal homes for creatures such as chimera and harpies, who are able to fly out over the grasslands in search of prey. Northern Steppes, the land of Kislev, or the ancestors of Kislev, they came from there. I always keep forgetting those names, but again, we will get there when we get there. You have the Gospodar, and you have something else. I don't remember. But the humans that lived there later became part of what is now Kislev. Goblinoids that roam the steppes, they later became the Hobgoblin tribes, the Hobgoblin Khans, which are very clearly based off of the Mongol culture. So this is, again, the seeds of what later becomes a lot more solidified. Next up is Cathay. Cathay is a huge land corresponding to the far east of our own world. The mid-coastal areas are temperate and fertile, whilst to the west and north lie great deserts and to the south impenetrable jungles. The Old Worlders have only just established trading contacts with this land and are not always welcome. Cathay is dominated by humans, although remoter areas are still under control of goblinoids, especially hobgoblins. There are many separate states and cultures within this area of varying sophistication and technology. The largest state is Imperial Cathay, where gunpowder technology is known but not fully exploited. Society throughout the East is insular and unenterprising, a situation enhanced by the universal Simca religion. The large island lying off the coast of Cathay is called Nippon, an independent state of tough, seagoing peasantry and stern feudal overlords called Shogun. Basically, China and Japan. The lore we get here for Cathay doesn't really become much developed in later editions of Warhammer, to my knowledge. This always remains this sort of vague land to the east, vaguely based off of China, but not with a lot of fleshing out, definitely not as much as the Old World gets. What we do get, however, is the computer game Total War Warhammer 3. Now, I have never played this game. I simply don't have the time to play many computer games nowadays, and I don't want to invest a lot of money in that, and knowing me, if I buy this game, then I also want all the extra downloadable content, so just not going to do that. I might do a bundle of it later at some point. But in Total War Warhammer 3, Cathay became a fully developed faction, and there were some thoughts that both Cathay and Kislev, all the concept art that they got for Warhammer Total War, Total War Warhammer, that would also be one-on-one represented on the tabletop. So back when we first started getting some news on Warhammer the Old World, we saw a lot of Kislev units, Kislev Bear Cavalry, some spells, a Kislev Polar Bear Drawn Cannon. Then we also got a whole list of Cathayan regiments with light, medium and heavy infantry and cavalry, gunpowder weapons, the war balloons, the different kinds of mages that they were able to employ. However, it's been very silent on that front with regards to Warhammer the Old World, and I don't think we will have to expect a Cathayan army anytime soon. Leaving Cathay behind us, we will travel now to the New World. The New World is a whole continent corresponding to North America in our own world. It is inhabited by humans and a host of strange native creatures. The northern areas were settled by the renegade Dark Elves many years ago, whilst the areas along the east coast have numerous sea elf colonies. The indigenous humans are Stone Age primitives, hunters of wild game and harvesters of seasonal fruit. They occasionally trade with the elves, but have little cultural contact with them. Here we see that the New World is mostly populated by humans and primitive human tribes, the Native Americans, but in later editions these are completely replaced by the Dark Elves, and this entire section, what is here called the New World, will then be in the hands of the Dark Elves. Next up, Lustria. Lustria is a vast continent dominated by jungle in the north and by huge rolling grasslands to the south. The most notable feature of the land is the mighty Amoco-Cadiz river system, which penetrates the most of the north of the continent. Apart from many exotic animals, Lustria is home to two kinds of native humans, Amazons and Pygmies, and the Slan. The Slan once ruled Lustria as the Aztecs ruled Mexico, and like the Aztecs, they have become the victims of foreign colonialism and greed. the remains of the once vast Slan Empire now occupy only the northernmost part of the continent. The Norse and Old-Worlder explorers, adventurers and traders who have ousted them have settled along the northeastern coasts. From here they launch expeditions inland in search of Slan gold or the natural treasures of the land, animal skins and mineral wealth. Again, a very different story than what we have in later editions. Here the Slan are almost extinct, only a few remain. In later editions, it is the Lizardmen that mostly populate Lustria. We get some reference to Amazons, we get a Mordheim Amazon warband, we get Anaconda's Amazons using the same models as the Mordheim warband, a regiment of renown. But other than that, Amazons don't really feature much in the Warhammer world, and it's mostly Lustria where the Lizardmen live. It's mostly Lizardmen that live in Lustria, almost exclusively. Pygmies have disappeared completely from the Warhammer world. I believe the last reference to Pygmies is in the 6th edition Ogre Kingdom book, where it talks about the giant Pygmies of some place or other, which are a regiment of renown that is mentioned, but which never got any rules. Next is on to the Elf Kingdoms, and if you have followed along, you may have noticed that we started in the Old World and then went east, and now have come back from the western part of the map, ending in the Elf Kingdoms. The Elf Kingdoms are the original homeland of the Elves and comprise of a large ring-shaped island and a number of smaller surrounding islands. The entire area is one of outstanding natural beauty, with a pleasant warm climate and abundant natural vegetation. The main island has a mountainous wooded interior with inward-facing and outward-facing coastal plains. The inward-facing coast is populated by high elves living in secure cities or luxurious palaces. There is little agriculture practiced here, rather the whole area is left as far as possible in a natural state. The outward coast is used for agriculture and for what few industries exist. It is populated by sea elves and there are many trading ports and harbors. From here, the sea elves guard the seaways between the old and new worlds. The greatest city in all of the elf kingdoms is Lothurn, situated upon either side of the harbor entrance into the inner seas. It is inhabited mostly by sea elves, and is unusual in that it is the only elf port that will admit foreign shipping, although all foreigners are restricted in their movement within the city itself. Again, here we see something that is being developed and will get more developed later on. Later on, the sea elves will disappear completely from Warhammer, being incorporated into the high elves, especially in the Lothurn Kingdom of Lothurn. Don't really know if that's the correct way to put it, but you know what I mean. Speaking of Lothurn, we already see that this city is already mentioned here, and it already has the same structure as what we see in later editions, where parts of it can be visited by humans. And that is the only elf city where humans can come, or other races can come. I should make this a little bit broader than just humans. Then finally we get to the last two areas. They have gotten their combined section, the Northern and Southern Chaos Wastes. The gnome world can be imagined as a sphere with north and south polar regions. But the poles of this world are subject to a very strange phenomenon. As a traveler approaches the polar regions, he becomes aware that all is not as it should be, that distances lose their perspective, that the geography seems strangely fluid and the weather and light increasingly erratic. Some distance from the pole, the physical laws of nature break down altogether, so that nothing is steady or predictable, and that all direction and distance is unnaturally distorted. These are the incursions of chaos, areas into which ships sail and never return, or from which strange monsters or warriors emerge to wreak havoc upon the known world. The incursions of chaos are not geographically fixed, but pulse in and out from the pole at irregular intervals. As they grow, these regions can be observed as a throbbing rainbow of color in the night sky. At such times, the inhabitants of extreme northern or southern lands flee from their homes rather than risk becoming caught up in the incursion. At their greatest, the incursions of chaos touch upon Norska in the north and southern Lustria in the south. No one knows for sure if the incursions have finite limits or not. Perhaps one day they will meet at the equator and engulf the entire world. Because the poles are unstable, their geography is in no way fixed. The known world map depicts the world as it is now, about 100 years after the ebb of chaos from the whole of Norska. This event was accompanied by invasions of chaos warriors and beastmen into Norska and the northern old world, an invasion which was thrown back, which devastated Norska and spawned many chaotic mutations, including the race of chaotic or black dwarfs amongst the Norse dwarfs. Whilst the incursions have now retreated, occasional bands of chaos creatures still wander across into the world, and the black dwarfs seem settled in northern Norska as a permanent feature. It was the incursions of chaos and the resulting disruptions amongst the Norse and Old Worlders that drove many of them to new lands such as Lustria and the New Coast. This also explains the high proportion of Norse and Dwarves who are now settled in Lustria. The incursions are not looked up as an evil by all. The worshippers of chaotic gods see the resulting insanity, bloodshed and slaughter as a holy process of catharsis and redemption. Well, to each their own, I guess. Again, lots of things that we read here in this short paragraph that have stuck for later editions of Warhammer. Chaos ebbing and flowing, chaos incursions coming when the power is strong. We see here the first mention of the Chaos Dwarfs, or Black Dwarfs as they are called, although they do not yet live in the Darklands, they live in the Northlands. It might be that in a later edition they migrate there, but I'm not too familiar with the Chaos Dwarf background to say that for sure, or whether this has just been retconned and that they have lived in the Darklands all along. Next, we get a timeline for the known world. The known world has evolved out of our own Warhammer games and campaigns. In redrawing the map and restating the history of the known world, it was inevitable that we should form some sort of general idea on how it evolved into the world of the present. Many of these ideas are rather vague, because to the current inhabitants, the events portrayed belong in the distant past. They are part of an entire unfathomable prehistory. So the timeline presented shouldn't be taken as definitive history. The events portrayed before the fall of the Old Slan are pure conjecture on the part of this author. This history will be of most help to the imaginative GM who is trying to fill out a known world campaign of his own. The timeline starts 100,000 years before the present. This is the time of the Great Ice Age. The greater part of the northern and southern hemispheres are held within the grip of mighty ice sheets. At the poles, these are many miles thick. In the north, they extend over the entire Old World. In the south, they cover much of the southern ocean and half of Lustria. All of the living species in the known world live within the equatorial regions of Cathay, the Southlands and Lustria. The Darklands are at this time rich and fertile. There is no civilization. Intelligent species live by hunting, using crude stone tools for weapons. Then we skip to 10,000 years before the present. The Old Slan appear. Perhaps they evolve independently in Lustria, but more likely they arrive in an advanced state from some other world. 9,000 years before the present. The end of the Ice Age. The old Slan altered the planet's orbit, causing a general increase in temperatures, rise in sea levels, and a withdrawal of the ice sheets to the extreme polar regions. We also get then the emergence of elves as a civilized species. The old Slan take stock of the animals living in the known world. For reasons best known to themselves, they transplant the emerging race of elves onto the island group later known as the Elven Kingdoms. The elves are now isolated from other intelligent creatures. With the retreat of the ice sheets, creatures of all kinds move into the north and south. Some creatures, including humans, cross over into the new world. 8,000 years before the present, the emergence of Amazons in Lustria. The old Slan choose from somewhere a group of humans. By some means, the old Slan tamper with their genetic structure, using them to create the race of Amazons in Lustria. Whether the Amazons are created to be workmates of the old Slan, or whether they are nothing more than a whim of these godlike creatures is uncertain. Then we skip another 1,000 years, 7,000 years before the present. Fall of the old Slan. Who can say how the old Slan fell from power? That they fell is certain, for the civilization collapses almost overnight. In Lustria, the remaining Slan retrogress into a strange barbaric people. They forget most of their old technology and powerful magic. The incursions of Kraeas are created. Many strange creatures are released into the world. In Lustria, the Amazonian sisterhood is founded. This is all part of 7,000 years before the present. The Amazons war continually on the new Slan Empire. Now we get to 6,000 years before the present. The High Age of the Elves. The elves have developed a lofty and high-minded civilization and begin to explore the world. This is a time of great sea voyages. In the new world, they begin to build new settlements. In the old world, they establish whole new kingdoms along the coast. The dwarves enter their own high age. Already, they are skilled metallurgists and stone workers. They put both abilities to use in constructing the huge stone cities and fortresses that are to dominate the world's edge mountains for the next 5 millennia. Rebellion and exile of the Dark Elves. Elvish settlements in the New World ends. 5,000 years before the present. Dwarves and elves live harmoniously together. Together they help clear many of the wild beasts from the Old World. At this time, men still live as barbarians without proper understanding of metalwork or agriculture. Dwarves and elves begin costly interracial war. And we also get the departure of the elves from the old world. Only a few isolated communities are left deep within the forests that are destined to become the wood elves of the old world. The dwarves are decimated and many of their fortresses fall into ruin. 4,000 years before the present, massive volcanic activity in the Darklands destroys what was formerly a fertile and pleasant area. Now it is barren and lifeless, lying under a blanket of airborne ash and smoke. Many of the creatures who used to live in the region, notably goblinoids, are forced to flee over the mountains. Also, the goblin-dwarf wars begin. 3,000 years before the present. Emergence of man in Araby and Cathay, and shortly afterwards in the Old World. Development of metalworking and agriculture, trade with the dwarves, and the beginnings of human civilization. With the help of man, the dwarves finally drive the goblins back into the Darklands. Hobgoblin invasions of Cathay are driven back by the first Simcists. 2,000 years before the present. The Old World is slowly deforested and cultivated by man. Remaining wild creatures and monsters are driven into the deeper forests or into the north. Old worlders establish and re-establish nations as they war continually amongst themselves. 1,000 years before the present, old worlders and Arabians begin a series of religious wars. These last off and on for the next 800 years. In the northeast of the old world, human nomad invaders establish themselves in sedentary communities. 500 years before the present, Norse and Old Worlders begin to explore the western seas. they discover the elves who prevent them from voyaging westward and deny them access to their lands. Elves once more sail to the Old World where they set up trading posts. Their monopoly of the sea trade is deeply resented, especially by the Norse. 200 years before the present, incursions of chaos become extremely active. Vast armies of chaotic creatures pour over most of Norska and the north of the Old World. The invaders are flung back by men aided by the valiant Norse dwarfs, but at terrible cost. Creation of the chaotic black dwarfs and the beginning of the chaotic cult worship amongst some decadent Old Worlders. 100 years before the present, Lustria discovered by Eric the Lost. The beginnings of settlement by the Norse, Norse dwarfs and later on Old Worlders. First contact of Man and Slann. The plundering and erosion of the Slann Empire. The new coasts discovered by descendant of Eric Lost Ericsson. The beginnings of Norse and Dwarf settlements of the new coast. And then finally, Zero, the world as it is today. The Old Worlders and Norse continue to exploit the new wealth of Lustria and the new coast. The Elves maintain their stranglehold on trade within the new world, but feel threatened by the new wave of human expansion. The Elves are not above holding or even confiscating ships and cargoes traveling between the new lands and the Old World. In response, many humans have taken to piracy, basing themselves in the many small islands off the coast of northern Lustria. Further exploration continues. Over the last decades, the Old Worlders have reached as far as Cathay. Meanwhile, the incursors of chaos are becoming active once more and threaten to trouble the entire globe. That is a timeline of the Old World. We don't know what the current year is because we don't yet have the Imperial calendar. And it is very hard to judge because some of these events have skipped around. Now, I do believe that in what is 7000 before the present in this timeline, that equates to around 5000 before the start of the Imperial calendar. So let's compare this timeline briefly to the final iteration of the timeline that we get in the 8th edition rulebook. There are of course a lot of more events in the 8th edition rulebook that are mentioned than the ones here, but let's just compare the ones that we've just gone over. So the 8th edition timeline does not mention an Ice Age. It starts with the Time of the Dragons and around 5900 before the start of the Imperial calendar. So that would be around 8400, if I say it correctly, before present in this timeline. We see the Slann appear. So it's a little bit earlier in the second edition timeline. The second edition timeline places it at 10,000 years before the present. Then we get the Great Cataclysm, the destruction of the Chaos Gates. The Chaos Gates are not mentioned at all. They apparently don't exist yet, or they are not known, or maybe they are just not known yet to the authors of Warhammer. But we see that in 7,000 years before the present. So that is really close to what we have here. The Great Cataclysm is about minus 5,600. So add 2,500 years to that, you're at minus 7,100. And going just by this event, that would mean that the current timeline in the second edition compared to later editions would end at around 2,400 of the Imperial calendar. Of course, we don't yet have an empire, so we also have no Imperial calendar. But yeah, let's keep going. We get the Sundering in minus 2700, so that would be around 5000 years before the present. And that is also when, just before 5000 years before the present, we see the Rebellion and Exile of the Dark Elves. We see the War of the Beard, which is between minus 1997 and minus 1560. So again, at 2500 years to that, so around 4,500 years before present, then indeed we see dwarves and elves begin a costly interracial war, and finally the elves depart from the old world. That happens in minus 1500. The last elf army departs from the old world in minus 1500. And that is in almost 4,000 years before the present. So far these timelines line up pretty well. We get the Goblin Wars mentioned. They were not mentioned here, but they are mentioned in first edition. So the Goblin Wars minus 1499 according to the 8th edition book. Let's see. Then we get a lot of things that focus mostly on the Empire and the things that have happened after that. We do see, for example, in... 2271 to 2304, the Great War Against Chaos. This is, I think, what is the incursions of Chaos that happened 200 years before the present. So still at around 2500. So that lines up with the 2500 years of the current timeline. I do not see very quickly in this edition when the Chaos Dwarfs were created. The Chaos Dwarfs, of course, having been out of the Warhammer timeline for most of everything apart from Ravening Hordes in 6th edition. They disappeared after 4th edition, after Hero Hammer. And then they got a new incarnation in Tamurkan in the 8th edition supplemental book. I have not yet read that, so I can't tell you by heart when the Chaos Dwarfs arose, but I think it would be safe to say that it was more than 100 years before the present timeline. As with the geography, the timeline lines up pretty well with later editions. There are some deviations, there are some things that are definitely not as fleshed out as they will be in later editions, but other than that, we get the Warhammer world as we know it all the way back here in 2nd edition. At this point, I think I will stop the episode. There is a lot to unpack here, and we have only scratched the surface of this book. Well, a little bit deeper than the surface, but this was only the first dozen or so pages. So I think going through all of the different races, their own individuality, their own background, their place in the world, that will take a little bit too long here at the moment. I will save that for the next episode for next week. As always, if you have any comments or questions or any advice, any experiences you wish to share, please don't hesitate to get in touch. I will give you the links to all the different channels, all the ways that you can reach me in the show notes, as well as in the standard outro I put at the end of every episode. If you want to share your thoughts on Warhammer 1st or 2nd edition, if you want to share your experiences, whether you played it back in the day, or whether you have just discovered this edition and are playing it now, I would love to have you on the show, have a little chat, and talk about what you like about this edition, what you dislike about this edition, why you still play it, why you picked it up, why you stopped playing it, basically anything. If you want to be on the show, if you want to tell us about that, please get in touch. I'm looking for some people, some community members who have experience with these editions and who want to share those experiences. For now, I'm going to sign off. See you next time. Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, you can reach me by email at forcesoffantasy@gmail.com. Go to forcesoffantasy.com for all news and updates. Come check out our awesome Facebook group, the Forces of Fantasy podcast community. And while you're there, give the Forces of Fantasy Facebook page a like. You can also subscribe to the Forces of Fantasy YouTube channel, where you'll find battle reports, playthroughs and more. Finally, if you like the show and you wish to support it, head on over to patreon.com/forcesoffantasy. There you'll find exclusive bonus content.